The ELCA assembly, it seems to me, overall, was an outstanding success. That's my judgment, and I haven't seen the judgments of the editors or the others who are making evaluations. But it seems to me, in terms of spirit and accomplishment and style, it was very well attended and very well received. We were about 1,050 or 1,100 in that range, numbers of delegates. And the votes on most of the crucial votes on the social statements, well, for example, we debated the abortion statement for 4 or 5 hours. But when we came to vote, the vote was overwhelming. 900 to 70. So it was a strong vote. And for the death penalty, and for the statement on ecumenism, and the statement on the foundation document for social statements, they were all very strong. So that in terms of accomplishments, I think we came together as a church at Orlando in a way that we haven't done before. Because there were all kinds of people saying, well, we're gonna give Chilstrom a race for his money, and we're going to have a big problem with abortion, et cetera, et cetera. And there were all kinds of predictions of doom and gloom. But there was a solid feeling all the way through that we were, you know, headed down the middle road, and we were not going to be deflected to the right or to the left. So in terms of accomplishments, it was great. In terms of spirit, it was also a success. For example, we had sessions every morning and every afternoon. But in the middle of those sessions, we would be interrupted with delightful little interludes. We had the National Lutheran Choir. Do you know the National Lutheran Choir in Minneapolis? Well, it's an outstanding group. And I'd never heard of it before. But they paid their way themselves to come down and sing for us. And they sang several times for, let's see, we started on Wednesday, and they sang on Thursday morning, Friday morning, Saturday morning, Sunday morning. And, well, and they sang on Wednesday night, too, at the communion service, the opening service. They were delightful. Every morning we had a brief devotions at 8:30 when we started, and then we had a more detailed, a more complete service at noon. And so we had outstanding preaching and music, and we had a James Nestigan. Those of you who live in the Twin Cities, you know James Nestigan? He took the assembly by storm. He is such a delightful person to begin with. And he has that Norwegian way of speaking, kind of backwoodsy a little bit. In fact, some people call him the Garrison Keillor of theology. And he has a delightful way of presenting things in a humorous way. For example, one time he opened his meditation by saying that some people told me that I have a more Norwegian brogue than Gunnar Stålsett, who had just represented the Lutheran World Federation. And of course, he has a reason to have a brogue because he was born there. And James Nestigan said, well, my response to that is to say, the best Norwegians came over early. I don't know what sense it makes, but it's funny, and he has a way of doing that. He was talking about the Lord's Prayer, and we broke it down into petitions, and each day, Wednesday through Wednesday, we had one petition of the Lord's Prayer that we were focused on. And we focused on Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done. And his point was, most of us want, when we pray, my will be done, my kingdom come. And what we're praying for is for God to take us over and let his kingdom be. And let his control be the controlling power in our lives. And so he just had a way of captivating us, and everybody wanted to get a recording, a tape recording of what he did, and He was superb. Well, I'll start at the beginning of the business sessions. Bishop Chilton reported first, and he reported in five areas. On evangelism, he said, "We are not a Christian nation, and we shouldn't pretend that we are. But rather, we should consider every congregation, every home, and every community a mission field." As we were saying this morning with Dean and Elaine Peterson, that God has no grandchildren. So we can't assume that because the grandparents or the parents were Christian, that the children will be Christian. As Dean said, we're only one generation removed from paganism. And we can see that in America today. So we need to recognize that there's a lot of work to do. And evangelism is the focus for our energies. Number two, we talked about social statements. Some people urge us not to have social statements. He said, if you don't want social statements, then you have to give up any right to say anything to society. That is, people who don't want social statements, they wanted the church to speak in other ways, and they have their own agenda. But don't do it in terms of social statements. But when you refuse to have any part of a social statement, what you're saying is you don't want to say anything, or you don't have anything to say to society. And then on ecumenical issues, he made some very interesting points on that score. He said that the division of the churches is a scandal if all we do is criticize. But if we have our own point of view, which is that we are a church dedicated to the proposition that salvation is by grace through faith, and that is our mission, then that becomes one color of the rainbow. And we need to have all these colors represented. Not that we have to have every shade of every theological opinion represented, but he feels that at this point in time, at least, that there is a purpose for us as a church, and that we need to continue to hold up the banner of salvation by grace through faith. And he's been told by other people who are active in the ecumenical movement that this is a mission that's worth doing, and we should not just fold our tents and go away. And so the effort of ecumenism is not to try to get rid of ourselves as a church, but rather to be as representative and as positive and as hopeful as we can in all the dialogues. One of the points that was made in the statement on ecumenism was that there are churches in the country where the issue of Jesus Christ is very important. And we say that in the statement, that we believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, and those who agree with us that can make that statement, we can have a dialogue with them. Well, the churches in New England have a unique problem. They have councils of churches up there, state council of churches, and you know, the New England Synod includes six states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Maine. And some of these state councils of churches have universalists and Unitarians in them. And so they don't have a clear statement that Jesus Christ is Lord. And the Lutherans have decided up there that in order to have fellowship with all the people, they need to allow that and to be part of the councils of churches anyway. And so the bishop of the New England Synod stood up and asked that we allow exceptions where it seems appropriate. And the delegation allowed that. So that might seem like we're compromising or giving away something, but it also seemed to me to be appropriate where it's done in a responsible way, where the Council of Churches and where the Synod, our Synod, feels that it's appropriate. The fourth area that the bishop dealt with was organizational matters, and that was a streamlining of our structure. And if we adopt the changes, or we did adopt them, but his proposal was that we adopt them in order to streamline our structure, and we might be able to save as much as $400,000 a year by changing the way we structure ourselves. And on finances, we're in trouble, and we don't have enough money. For example, at the national level, the first time we operated in 1989, we were $17 million in the red. We underestimated the amount of money that we could receive from the merged group, and we overestimated the cost that it would require to run the organization.
The opposite. You underestimated the cost and overestimated what we get.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right, all right. Overestimated the income and underestimated the cost. $17 million worth. And in 1990, we were still $4 million short of our goal. And by 91, we expect to be about $565,000. So we're gradually reducing the gap. But still, they had to let some people go. You probably heard about that. And streamline a little bit more. So we're gradually coming into a realistic estimate of what we can do and what we can't do. But we still need to press for as much giving to the national organization as we do toward the local congregation. And that brings me to the point that Mr. Pastor Allman, who is the secretary of the church, said that the key word for our structure is interdependence. That is, the congregation is the church, obviously, in the local setting. But you have to recognize that the synod is also part of that, and the churchwide offices in Chicago are also part of that. So we are interdependent on each other. And if we remember that and recognize that we need to allow for this interdependency, we'll be much better off. And then we had a report from the vice president, and one of the things that came out of her statement was, the will of God will not take anyone where the grace of God cannot keep you. The will of God will not take you where the grace of God cannot keep you. And I thought that was worth quoting. The secretary's report, in that he said, 1992 will be the 250th anniversary of the arrival of Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, the first Lutheran pastor, as far as we know, to arrive in America. He arrived in 1742. And by 1748, he had convened an organization, or an attempted organization, which eventually became the Ministerium of Pennsylvania. So he had a vision for the future of the Lutheran Church in America, and that has borne fruit. Then we move on to the statements. Oh yes, and I should say that on the positive side, the loan fund, the Mission Investment Program, has really improved a good deal. For example, when we started, you know what the loan fund is? That's the amount of money that is gathered by the churchwide organization so that it can be loaned out to different congregations who are in building programs. When we started in 1989, we had $14 million in that loan fund. And it's grown now to the point where we have $57 million. And I would commend it to you as a good investment. Because the rates of return, the rates of interest that are paid on that are easily as good as banks are paying, and commercial banks. And it's a solid investment. The church is not going to default on those loans. So that's a high point. The other good news about finances is that the World Hunger Appeal continues to attract money. And we have $11 million last year, and it'll probably be that much again this year. We re-elected Bishop Chilstrom on the second ballot. He almost made it on the first ballot. I think he was 8 votes or something like that short of having enough to be considered elected on the first ballot. And Secretary Allman also was re-elected on the first ballot. The vote for vice president was very close. We started off with Kathy Magnus from Colorado being the front runner. She was the front runner even on the open ballot, the first ecclesiastical ballot. And then we went through a second ecclesiastical ballot, and Sylvia Pate, who is a black woman, and she is the interim director of the Commission on Women in Chicago, and she was second. And a fellow by the name of Thorny Steele, a black layman. You can only vote for lay people for the vice presidency. Well, at any rate, we got down so that we had 3 people. The top 3 were Kathy Magnus, Sylvia Pate, and Thorny Steele. And each one of them made a little speech. They were allowed 5 minutes or 7 minutes or something like that. And they all did very well. Then that would have been the fifth ballot. And then on that ballot, Thorny Steele dropped away. And so we had 2 candidates, a white woman and a black woman, and the voting on that was extremely close. The final tally was 480 for Kathy and 479 for Sylvia. One vote. So Kathy is our vice president, and then on Sunday we had an exciting morning. Because what we did was to talk about the challenge that faces the women of the ELCA. And they have decided that their primary challenge is going to be children at risk. Children at risk around the United States and around the world. And the point was made that 40,000 children die every day. 40,000 children die every day of disease, starvation, and neglect. And that should challenge us as a church. And I think it was very sobering for everybody to hear that report. They used media, they used slides and movies and voice presentations. And the Lutheran World Relief representative said, he said, if 40,000 children were being killed every day, 100 on every B-52, no, what did he say? 400 B-52s, each with 100 children on it, were going down, you know, every day. That would make headlines, wouldn't it? But 40,000 children dying around the world in all these assorted places, quietly or unquietly or whatever, doesn't seem to make an impact. But it should. And that's a challenge the church faces, to attempt to address these issues and to attempt to challenge governments and other agencies to see if we can't reduce that number. Because that's a crime to allow that many children to die. The Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service has been in business for 52 years, and they have served us very well. And what they presented was the statement of a young man who is from El Salvador. And he told us in Spanish with the translation of what has happened to him as he tried to. He said he didn't want to serve in the military. And so his parents were killed by the military, and he decided that he had to escape. And so he walked out, and he walked through Mexico, and he got to the United States. And then he was put into a detention camp and put into solitary confinement in an American prison.
Down in the valley.
Yeah. And he's now been freed, and his case is pending on appeal. But he has a sister that he hasn't seen for several years, it's painful to think about how we run these camps. And anyway, hope for a hungry world, that was one of the themes. 32 million children live in poverty in the United States. We're the richest country in the world, but 20% of our children live in poverty. We debated four social statements. One on, the first one we adopted was on the death penalty, and we came down against the death penalty because it can't be carried out equally or fairly, and because we run the risk of executing an innocent person. And so in a variety of ways, we tackled that question, and we debated it, but there wasn't a great deal of debate. We were all rather sure that we are opposed to the death penalty. Probably that's not true in our congregation, but all of us that were there were a large, overwhelming majority were against it. Then we dealt with a foundation document on social statements, which listed the principles and the basis on which we make statements for or against. And that also was passed with a minimum of debate. And then we passed a document on ecumenism, and I've already referred to that. Then we took up the question of abortion. The abortion question was the most seriously debated and the most hotly contested issue that we had. We went through a number of attempts at amendment. We had one delegate from North Dakota who repeatedly stood up and tried to make us consider his statements, which were usually very anti-abortion. He's anti-abortion all the way, and it's a sin, etc., etc. And his language was very, very right-wing, at least what I would call right-wing. And he just didn't get a hearing. The delegation resoundingly put him down time after time after time. And there were other attempts at amendments. A few of those attempts succeeded. The most successful or the most significant amendment was to remove a whole paragraph. On page 4 of the document, you have this statement in the original. Beyond those circumstances, we as a church disagree on what conditions, if any, make abortion a morally responsible act. For some, those are the only conditions. Others would include additional considerations necessary for minimal quality of life for the woman as well as the child. Bishop Lazarus stood up. He's the bishop of the Metropolitan New York Synod. He stood up and said, "I move that we strike the whole paragraph." And then he went on to say that he feels that that statement can easily be misinterpreted. And he feels that the media would call us shilly-shallying and wishy-washy and et cetera, et cetera. So he moved that we take the whole paragraph out. And amazingly, that passed. That seemed to clear the air. And we were content to take that paragraph out. We say something along the same line at the very beginning of the document, but it isn't nearly as, you know, some say it's not enough, some say it's too much. It's just that it's a difficult issue, and we're never going to totally agree on the issue of abortion. But our document tends to focus on the needs of the people involved, okay? The mothers, the families, the fathers, potential fathers, etc., etc., and to focus on the needs of those people rather than to focus on whether abortion is evil. And we say it's evil, but we don't hammer on it in quite the way that Southern Baptists might or that some other more conservative group might. And then when the time came for a vote, you know, we had all kinds of procedural motions. How long we were going to allow for a debate on a question and how the vote was going to go and so on and so forth. And so it took us a long time. We extended debate for an hour and a half, beyond the time when we were supposed to finish. And when the final vote came, we, as I said earlier, we adopted the statement as amended by a very strong vote, 900-70. And I felt it was a positive vote. I'll read you the abortion statement sound bite. The 1991 Churchwide Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America approved a social statement on abortion September 3rd. Over 90% of the voting members expressed support for the document. The statement calls abortion an option only of last resort, quote unquote, but recognizes that difficult ethical choices sometimes need to be made, in which preserving the life in the womb is not the only value at stake. The statement lists as possible reasons for ending a pregnancy, quote, a clear threat to the physical life of the woman, circumstances of extreme fetal abnormality, and when the pregnancy occurs when both parties do not participate willingly in sexual intercourse, especially in cases of rape and incest. The statement seeks to, quote, move beyond the stereotypical pro-choice or pro-life positions to establish new common ground of crucial, biblically rooted values from both perspectives, end of quote. It calls upon individual Lutherans and the ELCA to work to change social conditions that contribute to abortion. Then we took up a number of memorials. The most significant memorial that we debated was one on 1992 as the year of Columbus. Columbus, you've heard of that issue, I suppose. The 500th anniversary of the Columbus's so-called discovery of America. And Native people in America are very concerned about that. That after all, they were here before Columbus, and he didn't discover us. He didn't discover America in any real sense of the word. It was a European discovery. And so on. So we've passed a memorial which calls us to remember, repent, and renew, and to cooperate with Native Americans in their efforts and other Americans of color, black and Asian, et cetera, et cetera, and to work for more understanding of the issues. Then we had some discussion about equalization of salaries, and that was a painful thing, that pastor salaries are not equal across the board or anywhere near equal, and some of them are far below the level that that others receive, and we're trying to come to some agreement on that, but that's going to be difficult. I don't know.
Al?
Yes.
Did Pastor Dr. Hume have the floor of the convention for that presentation of the pastor's salary?
What's his name?
Hume.
From Northwestern, Luther Northwestern.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Some time ago, I don't know how long ago, maybe last year, he had an article in the Lutheran on that. He had been in Australia.
Yeah. The Australian model is one that we talked a good bit about. We voted to study the whole question for another 2 years and bring back a report at that point. And then we talked a good bit about reference and counsel, study of theological education. Only 34% of the cost of theological education is paid by the church-wide organization. And some people feel it ought to be 50% at least. So students are being asked to raise the tuition, and some people feel that's unfortunate. Do we need 8 seminaries in the ELCA? And so on. I think those were the main points that I needed to cover. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
What seems to be the hang-up with the clergy salary that they cannot be equalized?
Well, every synod seems to have a different set of circumstances. But all synods, as far as we know, have a recommended minimum salary for every pastor. But usually there are one reason or another a congregation can't come up with that money. And they find a pastor who's willing to accept, even though it's not up to the minimum. And so there have been, you know, the possibility of all pastors contributing amount of money so that the salaries can all be equalized, and it's a difficult thing. See, if you work as a missionary, as Dean and Elaine did, or as I did, then you have one salary across the board. And the salary is adjusted for a number of years of service, for the number of children you have, and for the country in which you work. And basically, it's a one salary deal.